Kamenetsky Brothers Lando Lakers podcast. Brian Kamenetsky and Kamenetsky, co-host of the Lando Lakers vlog, coming to you Friday afternoon, August the
16th.
Interesting things that kind of popped up this week. First was the story in the Hollywood Reporter written by Rick Bucher. Most of you know him from his days at ESPN. And then a follow-up interview really based on the article that came out, prompted, I should say, by the article that came out, where Mitch Kupchak appeared on The Herd with Colin Cowherd on ESPN Radio.
Hey, Colin.
Appreciate you having me on. There's a lot of stuff that kind of came out of it in terms of good talking points. Not a lot of revelations necessarily in the Bucher story, but still a lot of interesting things. And I think the easiest place to start, the big takeaway, I think, for most people is that there's still a failure to communicate between the two people most responsible for steering the franchise going forward without Dr. Buss, Jeannie Buss, and Jim Buss. Those two people are still not on the same page.
No, they're very clearly not. You know what I did wonder, though, Brian, and I don't even know the answer to this, but I think it's worth asking. If they were better at keeping this lack of communication or being off the same page more private, I wonder how much it would actually matter in terms of the functionality of the organization and how well they could actually thrive.
Because
that's a good point. Their jobs, in theory, don't have that much crossover.
You know, you can find moments where, you know, the basketball side and the business side, Jim on one, you know, the basketball side, Jeannie on the other, overlap. I mean, I think the Dwight Howard billboard thing is a good example of that. And it obviously didn't work, and they've taken a lot of grief for it. And Jeannie told ESPN Radio last week that, you know, might not have been the best idea, but, you know, they're working through some things. I think maybe
we don't really know whose idea it was.
Right, but that that's an example of a situation where, you know, the business side, the people responsible for the marketing and figuring that and trying to devise plans to help the organization move forward overlap with the basketball side. But I think your basic point is a good one. And if nothing else, emphasizes they ought to stop sniping at each other ever.
I mean, it is actually pretty amazing that they haven't seemed to figure out the value of a united front publicly and just fake it. Just fake it at all costs. I mean, because we've been down this road with Jeannie and Jim, and I don't think it's nearly as bad or seemingly, you know, as hostile as it was, like, say, the summer of the radio tour when Kobe freaked out and Jim and Jeannie were really going at it publicly. And Jeannie said that Jim didn't support Phil, and Jim said he didn't really like certain aspects of Phil's coaching style. And down the line, I think they handle it better now than they did then.
It would be hard for them to do it worse.
Yeah, absolutely, but they still don't really seem to get the idea of you walk in lockstep, or you at least make it look that way, because it's all about presentation.
Yeah, and the big issue, and I think one that's overlooked, or if it's not the biggest issue, it's certainly a huge one. I wrote a little bit about this last week, and it came up again, and it was emphasized by Mitch Kupchak in the interview with Colin Cowherd, the absence of Dr. Buss and what that means in terms of how Jim Buss, Jeannie Buss have to, you know, it's such a massive change, and it's unfair to expect things to go smoothly. This is what he said to Colin Cowherd.
With Dr. Buss's passing, you have to give the organization time to work out, you know, a new way of working together.
Okay.
Dr. Buss passed away in the spring, and you can't expect things to go smoothly from the get-go. I mean, there's even strongly a period of mourning that has to take place. So I have complete confidence in all the kids, in particular the ones I work most closely with, which is Jeannie and Jimmy, that this is just going to be a fine and a well-operated run franchise going forward.
And again, that's Kupchak appearing on ESPN Radio with Colin Cowherd. This is such a huge deal because Jerry Buss, for all the, you know, the lead time people might have had, they knew he was going, and there's been this slow handing of responsibility to Jim Buss over the course of time and to Genie on the business side and all of these things. They had time to prepare, but there's still no way to fully get ready for losing somebody like Dr. Buss for a couple of reasons. First of all, Genie in that interview last week referred to the Laker way and just the way things they've done things over the course of time. Well, that is Dr. Buss. Dr. Buss was the Laker way. He was a visionary leader. He was the guy who set into motion the style in which they would go after players and the types of players and the way they would go about their business. But more than that, from a structural standpoint, he was also the guy who was still ultimately the final decision when they had big choices to make about signings and trades and things like that. This is something Jim Buss mentioned over and over and over again when he was trying to convince people that he wasn't Godzilla sent to destroy the city. That, look, my dad is still the final voice. He's still that guy. When you lose that, and now you have this power-sharing agreement without a real head at the top, that's a huge adjustment. And culturally, to get by without Dr. Buss and lose that vision, I compare it, and I think it's a fair comparison, to what Apple has gone through after Steve Jobs died. They knew he was going as well. And it's still a huge problem for them to kind of capture what made Apple great while he was there, especially when you consider how bit different the landscape is, both in that case, computers and technology, but also with the Lakers. The world they live in now is very different than the one that Dr. Buss bought into in the late 70s.
Well, I think there's also one other element that you didn't bring up, but that's definitely a factor with this in terms of turning that page, and that's the emotional side of it.
Sure.
You know, for so long, even as Jim and Genie were preparing for a moment that they knew was eventually going to come, there was still the safety of their dad being there and being able, not just being able to bounce ideas off him, but knowing that they weren't going to be perceived as having those final votes, particularly when it comes to Jim. And you know, really the part of the Laker way that fans really care about, you know, how the roster is going to be constructed, who you're hiring as the coach, all of that. There's now the emotional side of knowing that you're going to be doing this now without Dr. Buss, but also too, okay, that legacy now is on my shoulders for real.
Right.
You know, this is no longer a drill. This is no longer prep work. And I've got to do that now. And I also have to do that while I'm grieving my father being gone.
And I think that's a huge.
That's very difficult psychologically.
You heard Mitch talk about that. I mean,
and for Mitch as well.
Right. There's a mourning period, and they had to go through. You know, they had to go through that, or still going through that. And while you can call Apple, you know, you could say Steve Jobs is a father figure for Apple and all these other things. Dr. Buss was literally their father. I mean, he is literally the father of these people. I mean, and that adds an emotional component, like you say. Other stuff that I think was interesting, at least from that article, there was a quote in there that Bucher got, and we don't know from who, it was unattributed, that saying that, you know, we hear a lot about how brilliant Genie is and how stupid Jim is, basically. And this was a quote saying from one exec that's worked in that front office that, you know what, Jim's a lot smarter than people give credit for, that he's actually smarter than Genie.
And I, by the way, have enough respect for Bucher to believe that the source was not actually Jim Buss.
Yes.
Like that Jim wasn't actually the one that told him that.
Don't quote me on this, Rick, but I am smarter than Genie.
When you quote this, make sure that you use my name as opposed to I. Otherwise, everyone's going to know that this is coming from me.
MJ Usbe. This gets into some of the things with Jim that are, you wonder if they're a little beyond his control, because the narrative on him is pretty firmly written. And it's occasionally people will jump on the bandwagon of, hey, you know what? Maybe he's not so bad. Hey, they pulled off the Dwight Howard trade. Hey, they got Steve Nash. But it's sort of like it's been with Pau Gasol over the last few years. At the first sign of trouble, I mean, it's like rats off the ship. Everybody's gone. And where the one place where I thought the article was unfair, but I think it's instructive for understanding how people talk about Jim Buss and why they talk about him the way they do. Bucher used, again, referenced that quote that Buss gave in to Sports Illustrated about how if you put 100 people on the court, you know, and had them watch, they'd be able to do the jobs of scouts just as well and all these other things. And it's totally asinine and was an awful thing for him to say. And part of the reason he built the reputation that he did, Jim Buss, I mean. But it was also from a story in 1998. And at some point, you have to let people live down stupid things that they say and start judging them more on their current body of work.
It's like when people use Phil's book, The Last Season, as a means of criticizing Kobe now, you know, his lack of coachability now, or, you know, well, Phil couldn't handle him, you know, forgetting the fact that they resurrected their relationship and it was actually great. That doesn't mean that Kobe is easy to coach, but not for the same reasons that it was in, say, 2000. And certainly you can't say that Phil has a difficult time coaching Kobe now or at the last point where he did. And people still act as if the two of them were barely able to survive because in 2000, Phil wanted to trade him for Jason Kidd and Sean Marion. I mean, it's the same basic concept.
There are plenty of things that you can judge Jim on now, but he's never going to be able to turn it over and turn the page unless some of the older things from a different part of his executive life can kind of drop off the radar. In that sense, those are the things that I think are unfair to him. Because like I said, you can pick on him plenty for things that he does now, but if both sides of those things are there, he's never going to be able to break out of it.
Well, I mean, so much of this, though, has been about presentation and a narrative that Jim allowed to be created for him by media and then by fans, because for so long, Jim was just in the shadows and was never talking publicly. And he allowed this, you know, basic awful perception of himself to be created. I mean, you know, it's funny. We were talking about this article, and, you know, I know we're going to keep speaking about different parts of it, but the thing that jumped out at me in the beginning the most, more than any quote from Jim or from Jeannie or anonymous sources or Kobe or whoever, was the opening photo with Jim and Jeannie together and Jim wearing the baseball hat. And it's like, dude, take off the fucking hat. Take it off. I mean, you're a guy that at this point now, you are the face of this organization, and you are still having a difficult time convincing people that you really have, you know, the wherewithal and the seriousness and the savvy to do this. Wearing a baseball hat at 51 or 53, however old he is, with a, you know, semi mullet, is not the way you're going to convince.
It's not a semi mullet.
No, and you know what?
Remove the semi part. It's just
okay,
a mullet.
With a mullet, you're not going to convince people that you're the guy doing that. And maybe this stuff shouldn't matter. And I'm not even talking about him convincing me. You know, I'm not a formal person. This doesn't necessarily matter to me, but I know that it creates a perception of him. And at some point, he's going to have to step out of character a little bit with that. Maybe his dad could pull off the, you know, as mom likes to call it, the schleppy look. But that's because his dad has that many accolades and achievements. And, you know,
right.
Frankly,
10 titles will do that.
Well, and also, frankly, in the beginning, people doubted whether or not Dr. Buss could pull this off, and he managed to shut everyone up pretty quickly. And then from there, you can sort of be your own person in your own skin. But Jim, every time I see him in that hat, I just think to myself, you're killing it, dude. You're killing yourself. You are absolutely killing every single bit of image and goodwill that you're trying to build up. Take off the damn hat. Just take it off.
The part of the reason that Jim always looks bad, aside from the hat and the literal and the literal aesthetics of the way
take
he dresses and all that.
The hat, dude.
Right. Part of the reason that he always looks so bad is because he's always being compared to Jeannie, who is pretty and who is incredibly well-spoken and has a great sense of humor. And everybody loves Jeannie. And that makes him look bad too. And I know you have some thoughts about, you know, we pick on Jim a lot, but we don't pick on Genie as a media, as a fan base. And that may not be so fair to Jim either.
No, I mean, and I want to preface all this by saying I'm not looking, and I don't think you're looking, to try to, you know, detract from Genie or prove her to be a fake in the industry or something like that. I think
Genie Buss is very good at what she does. And there seems to, nobody seems to disagree that Genie Buss, in terms of marketing and handling the business end of things for the Lakers, is very good at what she does.
Right. And she's done a damn good job overcoming a lot of obstacles, you know, early in her career that come, you know, with just blatant sexism and being a woman in a very male dominated world. And she deserves a lot of credit for it. And she's a very smart, charming, like you said, savvy person. And I think she deserves a lot of the credit that she does get. But there's an inherent advantage that Genie has in terms of creating that great perception that Jim will never have. And it's that fans have absolutely no emotional attachment whatsoever to what she does. They frankly do not give a shit about what she does. The only Laker business they care about is the team payroll and money that would go towards the roster. And it's the one part of the business that she really has no control
right,
over.
I mean, you can make an argument that, you know, the payroll is a function of their TV deal, which she's involved in. The payroll is a function of the value of the team and how they're marketed.
Right, but that value was built up long before Genie was part of the process.
And it would, no matter if you and I ran the Lakers, they'd still have a big TV deal.
Exactly. I mean, that, you know, I'm not saying that Genie doesn't deserve credit for the organization being in good shape that way, because she obviously has to do work. But she didn't build that from nothing. That's her father. You know, I'm not detracting from Genie. I'm just being honest. You know, and I mean, Laker fans don't care how the team is marketed. They're hooked. So, I mean, nothing that she really does affects them in the slightest. And I got to be honest, too. I guarantee most fans have no idea really what she even does in the first place, like in a tangible sense. I would challenge any fan to put their finger on a decision that Genie made, you know, something that is credited with Genie Buss, good or bad. And I'm including me.
In the same way that you could point to Jim, and Jim is credited with picking Andrew Bynum.
Exactly. Okay. I mean, and there's a lot of positive assumptions that come, you know, towards Genie, because people don't really have anything tangible to put their finger on. And then, you know, the other things, like the way she has presented herself, to her credit, which has been fantastic. She does a wonderful job doing that. She's always been smart about understanding the value of outward appearance, but it does give her a benefit of the doubt that, you know, I mean, honestly, I think a lot of fans can't necessarily put their finger on why they feel that way, but it doesn't really give you tangible evidence either that she would do a better job running the basketball operations than Jim would. Honestly,
I will tell you two things where I think the reason why that, beyond the fact of her personal appeal, if Genie were to be put in charge of the basketball side of things, beyond the fact that I think people associate that with Phil coming back, but let's put that aside for just a second, because we actually have some more audio from Mitch to play on that subject in a second here.
And Jim has no interest in marrying Phil, and that can't be held against him.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with it, but I'm just saying you can't necessarily hold it against him.
No.
That his romantic relationship doesn't bring Phil potentially back in the fold. That is not fair to Jim. It's not even fair to Phil.
What if that was the rub?
He's actually in love with
Phil. Not to get too far off the reservation here, but what if that is the source of the conflict?
Jim feels like if I can't have Phil, nobody can, and
exactly.
That includes fans.
Exactly.
I'll say this. We need to source this out a little more before reporting it.
No, I've actually already started the post. Anyway.
We are neither reporting this. We're not even floating it.
Nope. But it's a theory.
That would, by Lakers standards of drama, that would be wild.
And it's hard to shock the fans of Los Angeles. Where I think Genie it would be better is because she has said many times that, you know, her you know, what did you learn from your father? To hire good people and let them do their jobs. And if she was in charge of the basketball side, what you would have is somebody who hires people to run the department and then stays out of their way, whether it's Phil, whether she keeps Mitch, whether it's a whole other bunch of people and this and that. And that, to me, is a huge aspect of it, beyond the fact that it would consolidate power into one person, which is, I think is ultimately going to be important, or at the very least, a major obstacle for the two of them, because power sharing is a very difficult thing to do. But, you know, I know when we talked about this, Andy, just or when the article came out, you used the word with Jim interfering with basketball operations. And I know that's a perception that a lot of people have. Well, Jim's over there interfering with what goes on the basketball side. No, he's not. Jim is the vice president of basketball operations. He's doing his job. His job is to interfere with basketball operations and get in on scouting and make trades and weigh and decide what free agents they're going to sign and all these other things.
Well, I want to clarify. No, I didn't say that I thought Jim was interfering. I just want to make sure people understand.
When you compare it to Jeannie, quote unquote, staying out of the way with Jim, and I'm just using it as an example because even if you're not exactly what you're thinking, the broader feeling from a lot of fans is all Jim does is get in the way. The problem is the title. Jim is a basketball executive. That's the problem. Because before, and I actually don't think this served him well, Andy, we've talked about this before, he could always say, well, you know, I'm not Godzilla here to destroy the city. My dad is really the
not
guy
even
making
the Mothra.
Right. My dad is making the ultimate decisions. It wasn't me who hired Mike D'Antoni. My dad, he actually said this, my dad made the final decision. I was just the one who delivered the news. And all of these other things. So to some degree, he was able to hide behind that and play that second role.
Actually, to no degree, because nobody bought it. Everybody thinks he's lying.
That may be. But he could always say, I am a basketball executive without that ultimate authority. Now he is the guy who is both signing the checks. I guess technically Jeannie signs them because she's on the business side, but you understand my point.
She can always refuse.
Right. He is the one who is choosing who gets the checks and deciding for how much and ultimately is making those decisions while also playing the role of basketball executive. And even if he was great at his job, and there's no evidence that Jim Buss is great at his as a basketball executive. There's some that he's not awful, but there's none that he's great. It's still a bad setup in professional sports now to be the guy who is both the owner and the personnel guy. To wear both of those hats is a terrible setup. We've seen it with Jerry Jones. We've seen it with Dan Snyder. It doesn't work. And in the long term, that's the biggest problem with Jim Buss. The other thing, though, that is a huge elephant in this story is obviously Phil. And part of the reason, like you said, that Jeannie has more ammunition over Jim. And this was, I thought, a very good question that Colin asked Mitch this week in the interview on ESPN Radio. Whether or not Phil is a helping hand, so to speak, and if it would ever be better if Phil would just stop talking. And here was Mitch's response.
We don't discuss it very often, but it's got to be hard. It really does. You know, Phil is a very close friend of mine, and he's an icon not only in the city, you know, but in the basketball community. And he's revered here. You know, certainly there was some feeling that Phil would coach this year, and then we hire Mike D'Antoni. And, you know, from the get-go, you know, he really, really has been under a lot of criticism.
He has.
So it can't be easy.
You know, do you ever call Phil and say, Phil, we're good friends. You're hurting us here.
I joke with him a little bit, you know, about the issue. But, you know, you really can't ask people, you know, not to talk and direct what they say. Phil's smart enough to know when it's time to say something And maybe after he reads it or hears about something he said, he'll say to himself, well, maybe I shouldn't have done that, or maybe I should lighten off a little.
Trust
his judgment.
Has Mike D'Antoni come to you and say, Mitch, this is difficult for me? Can you just stop? Can you stop it, Mitch?
No, he hasn't. But, Colin, he came from New York, too. It's not like, you know, he came from someplace where there was no criticism.
So he doesn't exactly say, Andy, yeah, we'd be better off if Phil wouldn't be so public. But you get that impression based on his tone.
Yeah, he wouldn't mind it if Phil kept these opinions, if not to himself, maybe just shared them with Mitch in private. Shared them with Jeannie in private, even shared them with Jim in private. But, it doesn't help the organization when Phil, and, you know, granted, a lot of this was during a book tour. And, you know, a lot of him coming out publicly talking about the Lakers, I think, was tied to him wanting to sell 11 rings. So you never know how much this will remain a constant. But it does not help the organization, or especially Mike D'Antoni, in terms of, you know, winning over the roster, winning over fans, you know, creating that image of stability, when Phil is constantly talking about how D'Antoni's using Dwight wrong, for example. That does not help anything.
No. No, it doesn't.
And
it really doesn't.
And honestly, though, you wonder why Jeannie wouldn't necessarily tell Phil, look, I get it and I agree, but I'm begging you to stop doing this. Because for the sake of the bigger picture, Jeannie has to understand that this doesn't help. I mean, she has to understand, even if she believes in everything Phil is saying, and I'm sure she does, it doesn't help at all. And I mean, it honestly strikes me as a bit passive aggressive on her part. I mean, do you think I'm wrong?
No, I think that's an aspect of it where, again, Jeannie kind of wields that influence or allows it to be done in a way that makes her look good, better, and she's aligned with the right side of the camp there, where everybody wants Phil back and nobody wants D'Antoni, or everyone wants Phil and perceives it as Jim, and I think largely true, doesn't want Phil back for a variety of reasons, some of which are basketball related, some of which, a large portion of which, is really personality and history. But yeah, there's no question. I think Jeannie could try at least to put more of a muzzle on Phil.
I mean, unless she's trying behind the scenes very hard and it doesn't work, but I don't get the
corralling Phil is not an easy thing to do.
No,
it's a little like
not
telling Kobe what to do, which as the coaching staff will tell you, is not easy. But you do wonder how much she's trying.
Certain situational elements put her in such a catbird seat that Jim can't possibly get in. And I don't think she's occasionally above manipulating it, or at least utilizing it at the very, very least.
I think that's fair. I definitely think that's fair. All right, Andy, we've reached the point in the show, everybody's favorite question and answer segment on a podcast, Ask a Kamenetsky.
Ack!
First question from at JeffLittle32. That's the handle of Jeff Little. What are your thoughts on D'Antoni seeking to play Jordan Chill 43, that's Jordan Hill, as a stretch four and and I believe it's pronounced Elias Harris. I heard that. I don't know if it's Elias, but I think I heard somebody say Elias, so I'm going to say both, or Ryan Kelly. So Jordan Hill is your stretch four.
Feels like a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, doesn't it? I see what you did there.
Yeah. You know, Brian, you and I in high school, we had the same college counselor who, no matter what school you brought up applying to, it could be like a 10th level community college, you know, basically somewhere where if you fill out the forms, they will take you. And his reaction was always just, seems like a reach, a bit of a reach. Not to get all Lee K on people, but this does feel like a bit of a stretch, bit of a reach when you take into account how Jordan's played his entire career.
Jordan, you know, he did a good job last year extending his range, but I do not think you will ever refer to Jordan Hill as a stretch four. I think basically what it comes down to is the Lakers don't really have that guy. I mean, you draft Ryan Kelly because he's got the skill set of a stretch four, but he's got also got, you know, he's coming off an injury, he's a second round pick, and he's pretty unathletic. So you have to protect him in ways that they may not be able to anyway. But, you know, that's the profile. I think they're not going to have that guy this year. I mean, Chris Kamen can step out and make a defense move out to 18 or 20 feet. Powell can do that too. But in terms of the Ryan Anderson type guy who stands in the corner and just bombs three-pointers, that is not going to happen.
No, it feels like a stretch. From you, Jess Tass, if you had to attach a functional third arm to yourself, where would you place it?
This is an interesting question, Andy, because it gets into a few different things. The first is functionality. Where is the most useful place to put a third arm? The second is tailoring, because you have to figure out how are you going to clothe this third arm. Depending on where you put it, it could be very awkward to get yourself dressed in the morning, or at the very least to find clothes that you can use to accommodate your third arm. Like, you wouldn't want it coming at, like, right out of the center of your back, because, you know, then how do you drive? You have to cut a hole in everything. So it's a little
tricky. Or the arm falls asleep a lot.
Right. And if you just put it below your other arm, then, you know, are you really getting the most out of it? Because now you just have two arms where there was one. But you don't have to do as much tailoring for, like a T-shirt. You know, you might be able to get something large enough with large enough armholes, a tank top, for example, where you could just slide both arms out of one armhole. So I think those are really the important considerations. I ultimately, in the end, I considered, wouldn't it be kind of useful to have an arm that you could have on your leg? So, like, you know, if you really wanted to either freak people out or kind of sneakily grab things while people weren't paying attention to your arms, you could deploy your leg arm to do that, maybe with a zipper system in your pants or something where
is that a third arm in your pants, or are you just excited to see me?
Both.
Actually, it is a third arm.
Yeah, why? Man. I considered that. But then finally I thought you'd probably get the most bang for your buck there if it really was almost like, what do you call those like 8-armed or 12-armed, you know, the Hindu,
spiders?
No, the Hindu god with the, you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I forgot his name.
But you know what I'm talking about? Know,
yes.
That
yes,
kind of thing. Just put the arm kind of below the other arm. So on whichever hand you have, you just have a third arm. I think it's probably conventional, but that's the direction I went with.
In terms of giving people, Brian, a visual example of how maybe this could work, in 1991, there was a movie called The Dark Backward with Judd Nelson. And he played this very painfully socially awkward wannabe stand-up comic with no talent whatsoever. And mysteriously, this third arm grew out of his back, Brian, as you said, a bad place.
Problematic.
But it became his hook. All of a sudden, he became known as Desi the Three-Armed Wonder Comic. He had a hook, and he started to get some traction, and then the arm inexplicably fell out, and then his career torpedoed again. But before that happened...
Well, honestly, Andy, it seemed like... No matter where the arm grows, you have your hook. So I wouldn't worry about that.
This is going to be shocking you, Brian. This movie, The Dark Backward, it was not a hit, according to Box Office Mojo. It made, in its theatrical run, $28,654. Domestically, no word on international. It is ranked 10,301 for all-time domestic gross.
It's hard
to believe it was that high.
It's only a couple bucks behind John Carter.
You know what's amazing, though? Seriously? I lived in L.A. during the time when this movie played in its one theater during its domestic release, and I actually saw it in the theater.
Where are you putting your arm? We never answered that question. Where are you putting your arm?
I'm going to go behind the back. It worked for Desi.
All right. Next question from Los Real Ali. Second week in a row, again, rewarding those who ask good questions. What comic book superhero would make the best Coen Brothers movie?
I think it depends on whether you're talking light Coen Brothers or dark Coen Brothers, Brian, because they go very, very strong on both ends of the spectrum. If you're talking like, you know, Blood Simple or Miller's Crossing or No Country for Old Men, that type of dark Coen Brothers. I would say The Incredible Hulk, because you deal with a lot of duality, a lot of rage. You're going to see a lot of scenes of David Banner, you know, just walking down the highway by himself looking to thumb a ride. I think that would work great for Coen Brother visuals. If you're going silly Coen Brothers, like Raising Arizona or The Lady Killers, Oh Brother Art Thou, that type of stuff, I'd say Plastic Man. Plastic Man would work fantastic as a Coen Brothers character.
Yeah, I think, by the way, the world needs a third Incredible Hulk film, so that's a good choice.
Well, actually, now it's part of the Avengers. He's now a main character in there, and by the way, he was clearly the one character that they could not figure out what to do with.
I haven't seen it. I'm like the only person on the planet who didn't see the Avengers, but
it's too long.
I think you know, you kind of touched on it with the lighthearted movies. I think what the Coen Brothers are great at is taking, I don't want to use insignificant people, people without, you know, but who have big dreams and big hopes. You know, Nick Cage's character in Raising Arizona is this guy, you know, who's obviously had a bit of a tough go, and he's in and out of prison, and he's living, you know, in this wasteland out in the middle of the desert and all these other things, and they don't have a lot going for him, but they have kind of big dreams. And the Lady Killers, these are people, low-level podunk bank robbers, you know, who have big aspirations. And Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, same kind of thing. What about a guy like Aquaman? Kind of a low-level guy. Not a lot of respect. Very limited in what he can offer. You know, in that episode of The Super Friends, when there was no water to be had, Aquaman really didn't bring much to the table. Guys like him, Aquaman.
Became like Fredo in The Godfather.
Hawkman. People like that who are limited in their scope, but really want to be more. I think that would be good for the Coen Brothers.
Okay, that absolutely makes sense. Next one, Brian, comes from @DirtbagMax, Max Gomez. Who wins between Ivan Drago and Clubber Lang?
Ivan Drago wins that. He's a perfect killing machine, as we saw. And while I think Clubber Lang has some skills that people maybe not have recognized because he was so flamboyant and he was such a showman, I think, you know, Drago, the only person that could defeat Drago was Rocky. Nobody else would have the ability to stay on his feet through an absurd, almost parody of boxing that Rocky absorbed in that critical fight, which not only defeated Ivan Drago but ended the Cold War. I don't think there's anybody else that could have beaten Rocky.
I agree with you, Brian. As tough as Clubber Lang was, he was from the south side of Chicago, after all. He was only 5'10", maybe 6 feet with the Mohawk. And Ivan Drago was nearly 6'6". So Clubber Lang's going to have a lot of trouble with reach. Ivan Drago is juiced, so that works in his favor. Everything he hits, he destroys. So I have to agree with you that in the end, it ends up the Russian triumphing. Interesting fact about Dolph Lundgren that I recently learned. The guy is a genius. I didn't know that. He attended the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, then got a master's in chemistry and was awarded a Fulbright scholarship to MIT. Dolph Lundgren.
Who knew?
Who knew?
All right. Well, really? One last thing before we go. A little segment we call Recommendations. Andy, what are you bringing to the people this week?
I'm recommending a piece. It's about a week old on Grantland called Tyrann Mathieu and the Two Sides of Sports. It was a really good piece by Andrew Sharp about Cardinals defensive back Tyrann Mathieu, rookie, the Honey Badger, as everyone came to know him. And it's a really well-written, empathetic piece about a guy who had a, you know, very famously rocky college career. And Sharp is rooting for him to succeed at the NFL level. And it gets really into why we as fans, and in his case, media, can develop emotional connections to players. And, you know, it happens to everybody. And also, too, I knew that Mathieu had a difficult childhood. But until reading this piece, I had no idea just how tough it was. And it's staggering to think about just how hard it must be for him to trust anybody or even just to feel loved. And, I mean, it's a really well-written piece. So I would recommend that.
I would send people to theverge.com to read a story called Your Meat Addiction is Destroying the Planet parentheses, but we can fix it. It's a cool look. Not, it's a really about engineering beef in a world going forward where grazing land and all of these other things are going to become more scarce as populations grow and demand for protein products gets larger and larger. And there's a lot in there about the development of alternate proteins and this and that and so on. And, you know, it's not, there's a lot of environmental stuff in there and a lot of meat eater versus vegetarian and all this, but really what it's about more than anything is it's a really fascinating look at the way that we might need to start eating and the way we produce food and all of these questions about consumption over the next, you know, 20 to 25 years. May or may not agree with everything in it. You may dispute some of the science in it, but it gets you thinking about a lot of very interesting things. So it's an article by Laura June on TheVerge.com. All right, Andy, until next week, is there anything else that you would like to bring or say?
No, I'm good to go.
All right, we'll see everybody next week.